Good morning. My name is Michael McCusker. Happy Thanksgiving. If I were looking forward in this new millennium and adolescent century from an earlier era, perhaps the 17th century of the second millennium, I would wonder if for all the ferocity and wars during that volatile century, the devastating 30 years war in particular, that I was living in a much safer time than now, the third decade of the third millennium AD. I might see the chain of violence become more mechanized, more lethally organized, using vast amounts of humanity, wars that involve the entire world until it inevitably ends in obliteration of the species through violent attrition and such offshoots of violence as poisoning the very atmosphere that allows breath. If I could see ahead as clearly as Nostradamus claimed able to do, perceiving perhaps the consequences of directions, I would consider myself relatively safe within the virtual center of human civilization, advanced enough to enjoy more than short-lived drudgery and feudal peonage, and not yet dwell in the dread of increasingly menacing surge of technologies humanity incessantly develops in its intellectual surge toward annihilation. Engrossed perhaps in the New York Times Atlas of the World History, looking in on various periods as though I were glancing at them through a porthole. For instance, a synopsis of colonial America, which capsulated three centuries into patterns of European movement across North and South America, their wars against their mother countries and each other, and of course, native peoples who were essentially obliterated. The ultimate defeats of all alien interlopers but the Spanish and English, who might have titanically clashed had not their own imperial ambitions been thwarted by uprisings of their colonies throughout the Western Hemisphere. The essential war between newly unchained colonials was with Mexico, started by the USA in 1846, although a short, bitter fight for Texas in 1836, remember the Alamo, was its prelude, fought by Yankee-speaking descendants of colonists against Iberian heritage imperialists. The 1898 war with Spain was perhaps the peak which ended Spain's last vestiges of its three-century colonial American empire, leaving its colonial descendants ascendant over the entirety of the South American continent, also the central, infamous, and all of Mexico of the northern continent. Independence from their European mothers has not been placid. South and Central America have been riven with continual rebellion and internecine wars. Cuba and Chile provide double negative examples. Also, I read of trade and empire in Africa from 1500 to 1800 via a couple of pages of very graphic maps of great black African civilizations built along the green Sudan fringe of the Sahara Desert and the Niger River. Also along the southwestern coasts, such as the brilliant Kong State in the Congo Basin and the ancient stone city of Zimbabwe, the expansion of Islam into southern Africa. The European sweep into Africa started with the Portuguese in the 15th century of the last millennium, just before Spain defeated the final Moorish stronghold of Granada and began its long colonial surge across the world. The slave trade of African blacks was started by the Portuguese and practiced by all European colonial powers until the end of the 19th century. I was interrupted reading the historical atlas that day when Connie Kimball told stories and histories of gypsies on KMUN, who originated in India and have spread all over the world, a historical bands of dancers and fortune tellers who were distrusted and continue to be persecuted almost everywhere they go, yet possess philosophies of freedom and hearty living, lovers of the earth and wanderers like our ancestors of oldest times. The world thought it had seen the last gypsy 100 years ago, Connie quoted a woman writer, but the current gypsies are as free and passionate as ever. Half a century ago, in the previous millennium, young, mostly white and affluent Americans were drawn together through their antipathy for the Vietnam War and tried to restructure American society. They turned to animistic socialism, as well as hallucinogenic drugs, and developed a political philosophy that could loosely resemble gypsy law. They paradoxically attempted to integrate political socialism with an indigenous tribal legacy of individual freedom practiced by America's original inhabitants. The young socialist reformers were ultimately unable to resist the lurid capitalist credo of their parent culture, however, and most advocates of peace, love, and joy culture abandoned communal politics, though their brief flirtatious fling left permanent sympathies for the ideas and philosophies of humane governance. Now those young hirsute heretics are the USA's cultural elders. The Star-Spangled Republic is once more in a terrible fix with a democratically elected fatuous fascist as its next president who, like Grover Cleveland in the late 19th century, leapfrogged from a first term over another administration for a second blast of Trumpian tyranny. Thanksgiving is suddenly metamorphed into nostalgia. Immediately, Donald Trump once again enters the White House. He plans massive purges of American citizenry. Unless anyone can absolutely prove they are native-born or documentary citizens of the USA, a massive purge of actual or suspected non-citizens will most likely be ruthless and unsparing. The USA will feel like a shadowy Nazi Germany under Hitlerian intolerance, especially when this form of Trumpian inquisition and the unnecessary chill it imposes upon American rights to emancipation from historical oppression. And now, from the New York Times, will the Supreme Court stand up to Trump? Can it? And it's by Stephen I. Vladeck, who is a professor at Georgetown University Law Center. Because of all that has happened since President-elect Trump's first term in office, it is easy to forget that the Supreme Court repeatedly stood up to him during those chaotic 4 years. The court impeded Mr. Trump's initial efforts to ban people from 6 Muslim-majority countries from entering the United States. It blocked Trump's attempt to put a question on the 2020 census, asking whether the respondent was a U.S. citizen. It rejected his effort to rescind the program that shields people brought to the United States as children from deportation and allows them to work. It ruled against him in a high-profile subpoena dispute, and it sat on its hands, as Mr. Trump and his supporters tried to use the legal process to challenge the results of the 2020 election. Trump won some big cases, too, but his track record was surprisingly poor for a Republican president before a Supreme Court with a majority of Republican-appointed justices. Now, with Republicans looking likely to control both chambers of Congress by the time Trump is inaugurated for his second term on January 20th, and with fewer moderating influences within Trump's own party to restrain him, it seems inevitable that the court will once again be the last institution standing between Trump and whatever he wants to do. The problem for the court and for the Republic is that it's going to be much harder for the justices to push back this time around, even if they want to. That is because of a sharp decline in public support for the court, which has plummeted, no doubt in response not just to the justices' controversial rulings, but also to the ethically questionable behavior of some of them. Without that public support, what would happen if Trump simply ignored a decision by the nation's highest court that he doesn't like? It is a question that until now seemed largely unthinkable. Yet the vice president-elect, J.D. Vance, suggested such a scenario in a 2021 interview in which he first said Trump should fire, quote, every civil servant in the administrative state, unquote, and, again a quote, replace them with our people. And then he added, when the courts stop you, stand before the country like Andrew Jackson did, and say the Chief Justice has made his ruling, now let him enforce it. Although the Supreme Court's formal power comes from Article 3 of the U.S. Constitution, its real power comes from public support for the court as an institution. The court depends upon the elected branches for everything from its budget to its building to its calendar and its statutory authority to hear almost all of the cases that it decides. And as much as the court could not hear and decide cases without that support, what's even more important is public support for its judgments, not necessarily because the public agrees with them, but because it agrees that in our constitutional system, those judgments should be enforceable. Regardless of whether, as Vance suggested, President Andrew Jackson actually said John Marshall has made his decision, now let him enforce it, it was President Dwight Eisenhower's deployment of troops into Little Rock, Arkansas, that desegregated Central High School, not the court's judgment in Brown versus Board of Education. Eisenhower chose to make sure the court's mandate was honored. Presidents unhappy with Supreme Court rulings have nevertheless complied with them, historically because of the political consequences of not doing so, like President Richard Nixon after the Watergate tapes case, or President George W. Bush after the Guantanamo habeas court case held that the detainees there have a constitutional right to go to federal court to challenge their detention, and not because of anything that the court itself could do beyond issuing a paper judgment. But the Supreme Court at the beginning of Trump's second term looks very different from the Supreme Court at the end of his first term. This is the court that, in ideologically divided rulings, overruled Roe versus Wade, slammed the door on racial preferences in college admissions, greatly expanded the Second Amendment, kneecapped the administrative state, and, perhaps most significantly, blessed stunningly broad presidential immunity from criminal prosecution in the specific case of Trump himself. Whatever merits of each or all of these rulings, what cannot be denied is that they have had a damaging effect on the court's popularity and, consequently, on the court's ability to defy the wishes of the elected branches. Indeed, some surveys show public support for the court nearing a historic low. Data aside, there's no question that the court has less credibility among large swaths of the population today than it did as recently as a decade ago. And yet, it's easy to imagine circumstances in which defying the wishes of the elected branches will be more important in 2025 or 2026 than it was in 2017 or 2018. After all, the other political checks Trump faced during his first term, moderate Republican senators with decisive votes like John McCain, or a Democratic-controlled House from 2010 through 2021, are likely to be absent, nor, assuming he abides by the 22nd Amendment, limiting a president to two terms, does Trump have to worry about running for re-election. Based on Trump's first 4 years in the White House, it stands to reason that there will be at least some cases in which his behavior goes too far for a majority of the current court, just as there have been cases in which even this court has pushed back against the excesses of Republican governors or conservative lower courts. If the court rules against Trump and he tells the justices to pound sand, what will happen then? Writing in 1952, in an opinion rejecting President Harry Truman's unilateral seizure of steel mills during the Korean War, Justice Robert Jackson reflected on precisely this problem. Jackson knew of what he spoke. After serving as both Solicitor General and Attorney General to President Franklin Roosevelt, Justice Jackson had also served as the lead U.S. prosecutor at the Nuremberg War Crimes Tribunal, where, among other things, he saw what had happened in Germany when legal institutions in a constitutional democracy did not sufficiently push back as popular political leaders claimed ever more power. With all its defects, delays, and inconveniences, Justice Jackson wrote, men have discovered no technique for long preserving free government except that the executive be under the law and that the law be made by parliamentary deliberations. Such institutions may be destined to pass away, but it is the duty of the court to be last, not first, to give them up. Justice Jackson's experience had taught him that judicial power is fragile, that it depends upon public support, and that the entire system is jeopardized when the courts lose their ability to stand up to other institutions of government. That is why it is so essential for the justices to worry about the court's public support, even in calm times. For it is when the rule of law is directly threatened that the court's credibility and legitimacy become imperative. And that was, Will the Supreme Court Stand Up to Trump? Can It? By Stephen I. Vladeck, who is a professor of law at Georgetown. And he writes the one first weekly Supreme Court newsletter. And he is the author of The Shadow Docket, How the Supreme Court Uses Stealth Rulings to Amass Power and Undermine the Republic. He wrote this for the New York Times. And now, a poem by Juanita Huebner. The Silent Keepers of the Box. We are starting out from pure silence into a box of old broken moons and paragraphs, written quickly by the tongue of technological fury, under the luminous absence of the heart. Some of the words we read have bloodied arrow tips. Others look now like burned flowers. And still others hide at the bottom of the box, with trembling wings, remembering. We shall not move from this box until the mouth of this universe listens to the full circumference of dignified eyes and walks blind down the soul's corridor, feeling its way along each vein without a compass, boots, nor a knife. We will pry open the lid for more light, only after expectation sweeps its scattered debris of arrogance and war into sad little piles of thorns. And when solitude is left to whisper ancient chords, like minor, beautiful waves washing over the bones of the dead, like a long rain crying out from a blue silence. And that was by Juanita Huebner, The Silent Keepers of the Box. This is Michael McCusker. Joanne Rideout is this program's engineer. Some thoughts with your turkey. Remember that our Thanksgiving is the result of stealing the continent away from civilizations which we buried and whose descendants we continue to treat with benign contempt. Remember that our intrusion wiped out entire species of wildlife and rendered others close to extinction. Remember, we made slaves out of a race we have never quite unchained. If we are to be truly thankful, we must remember how much of our bounty has been taken from others and how much we owe in return. Though the USA faces an age of internal political and ethical adversity, we have more than any other people at any other time. Yet many among us are poor and hungry and feel neglected and oppressed. We might remember we have the means and perhaps yet the will to remain equal and independent despite adversity and tyranny. Thanksgiving today is already an epic of nostalgia. Unless anyone can absolutely prove they are native-born or documented citizens of the USA, the purge of non-citizens under Trump's reign will most likely be ruthless and unsparing. The USA will most likely feel like Nazi Germany under Hitlerian intolerance, especially when questioned about the purpose of this form of inquisition and the unnecessary chill it imposes on American rights to freedom from legalistic harassment and punitive legality. Happy Thanksgiving.
You've been listening to A Story Told on KMUN, featuring Michael McCusker, journalist, activist, former firefighter, and Vietnam veteran. Michael has been sharing essays and poetry on A Story Told since 1987. For 30 years, he published the North Coast Times-Eagle newspaper out of his home in Astoria, Oregon. Michael currently shares his work and the works of other authors from his home on the Central Oregon coast. Join us here next week for A Story Told.